that Earthwatch with Robert Knight was brought to you with Portions on Recording. You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org online, anywhere in the world. Stream.WBAI.org is the place to go if you want a shortcut. Also, but if you go to WBAI.org, the main thing, yes, we may not be pitching this morning, but the auction is still going on, and you can always go to the pledge page. I just know that you're saying, oh, they're not pitching. How can I give money to WBAI? Well, go to WBAI.org and find out. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, imagination, and enchantment. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, is it the last ever episode of Hour of the Wolf? Well, it is if the world ends on the 21st. If it doesn't, we'll be back next week. But it's time for another apocalyptic show. Stay tuned. Okay, well, back to a semi-normal show this morning. So, it is, What is today's broadcast date? It is the 20th, the penultimate day before the end of the world. As I mentioned last week when we were pitching, talking about the end of the world and all that, we had a number of apocalypses just in my lifetime. There was, of course, the one where there was the passing planet and people killed themselves to get onto that planet before it would happen. There was, of course, the Jim Jones debacle south of here. Last year, 2 years ago, Harold Camper, this bizarre right-wing ultra-Christian, declared the end of the world, that he'd been working it out, and that was the classic Revelation-type apocalypse for a date that he had worked out years and years before, got people to sell all their belongings and stuff like that. And then when the world didn't end, he declared another one, which is actually, again, about this time of year in December. December's very popular time for apocalypses. And I was thinking of, originally we were going to have a guest this morning, Mary Robinette Kowal, but she was reading at KGB Fantastic Fiction tonight, and it was too much to ask her. I mean, she's a performer and she's a trooper and she knows how to do it. And so actually, if there's anybody who could pull off doing a live reading for a bunch of people starting at 7 p.m. and then hang out for a while and start doing a radio show at 1:30 in the morning, Mary's probably one of the few people who could really do it. However, given the fact that she's got to take a plane trip back home in the early afternoon, it seemed like a bit much. And also, we had her on the air, about 10 weeks ago, broadcast a long, extended interview with her, that was recorded in Washington, D.C. during the Nebula Awards. So I decided, okay, it's time for some apocalyptic stories. And first, I had mentioned I'd mentioned this online, on Facebook in the Hour of the Wolf group, and somebody said, oh, you got to play this song and that song, which were actually both songs that I played last week, and Shaboom, which is a song I don't really know. I probably do, but not by name. And the guy said, oh, and you got to do 9 Billion Names of God by Arthur C. Clarke. Now, I had been thinking of Inconstant Moon by Larry Niven, which would take a little over an hour. That's actually in some ways good, because that means, hey, don't have to, you know, worry about the rest of the show. But that's a almost apocalyptic story. Then there's also the one, I don't remember the name of it, the fabulous Bradbury story in which the night before the end of the world, where the world is going to burn up in a ball of fire the following day, the parents, to save their children the agony, the parents poison their children in their sleep so they won't have to go through the agony and wake up to a literal holocaust, only to find that that apocalypse never happens. It's a chilling, nasty, nasty little horror story. Other horror stories? Where did I leave my coffee? It's in the newsroom, I'll bet. Hey, Sydney, if you can hear me, if my coffee's in the newsroom, could you do me a favor? Bring it hither. So anyway, well, not to give away spoilers, but this listener and friend Alan Reed said, 9 Billion Names of God. And I thought, yeah, that's apocalyptic. But it's very short. Well, relatively short. Ah, but what goes with that? The Star by Arthur C. Clarke, which is also about a limited apocalypse, at least for one world. And it's a Christmas story. In many ways, it is The Christmas Story. What a double feature. Now, of course, WBAI had produced the classic reading of the star, Baird Searles, who, if you were listening a few weeks ago, when 2 weeks ago, when we played The Council of Elrond, that fabulous, mellifluous voice of our wonderful drama and literature director, when we had a wonderful drama and literature department, had recorded this reading that for many, many years, between Sydney and I and other people, we had played this every year at Christmas time. And I could not find that recording. I have it somewhere. I thought Sydney has it. Sydney says, I've got it. So I'll trust Sydney on that. But these make a good double feature, so I am going to read both. Now, I haven't quite decided the order. I think 9 billion names of God first, and then the star. I think that's what works. But you know what? I'm going to prep for it. I don't have anything in front of me to drink. I do a live reading. I can't do it dry. So I'm going to play you a cut of music, and then we're going to come back with The 9 Billion Names of God by Arthur C. Clarke. And in the meantime, here is a cover of a Kink song as performed by Elvis Costello, which is, well, at least from a movie called Until the End of the World. So how about that?
Thank you for the day. Shines on you, believe me. And though you're gone, you're with me every single day, believe me. Days I remember all my life, days where you can't see wrong from right. You took my life, and then I knew that very soon you'd leave me. But it's alright, now I'm not frightened of this world, believe me. I wish today could be tomorrow. The night is dark, it just brings sorrow, let it wait. Thank you for the days, those endless days, those sacred days you gave me. I'm thinking of the days. World, believe me.
From the soundtrack of the motion picture Until the End of the World, a song by Ray Davies, first done by the Kinks and covered by Elvis Costello. A lovely, lovely rendition of that song. And the Kinks version of that is pretty good, too. Okay, so welcome back to Hour of the Wolf. And here is The 9 Billion Names of God by Arthur C. Clarke, written 1951. This is a slightly unusual request, said Dr. Wagner, with what he thought was commendable restraint. As far as I know, it's the first time anyone's been asked to supply a Tibetan monastery with an automatic sequence computer. I don't wish to be inquisitive, but I should hardly have thought that your establishment had much use for such a machine. Can you explain just what you intend to do with it? Well, gladly, replied the Lama, readjusting his silk robes and carefully putting away the slide rule he'd been using for currency conversions. Your Mark V computer can carry out any routine mathematical operation involving up to 10 digits. However, for our work, we are interested in letters, not numbers. As we wish you to modify the output circuits, the machine will be printing words, not columns of figures. I don't quite understand. Well, this is a project on which we have been working for the last 3 centuries, since the Lamasery was founded. In fact, it is somewhat alien to your way of thought, so I hope you will listen with an open mind while I explain it. Well, naturally. It is really quite simple. We have been compiling a list which will contain all the possible names of God. I beg your pardon? We have reason to believe, continued the Lama imperturbably, that all such names can be written with not more than 9 letters in an alphabet we have devised. And you've been doing this for 3 centuries? Yes. We expected it would take about 15,000 years to complete the task. Uh-huh. Dr. Wagner looked a little dazed. Now I see why you wanted to hire one of our machines. What exactly is the purpose of this project? The Lama hesitated for a fraction of a second, and Wagner wondered if he had offended him. If so, there was no trace of annoyance in the reply. Call it ritual if you like, but it's a fundamental part of our belief. All the many names of the Supreme Being, God, Jehovah, Allah, and so on, they are only man-made labels. There is a philosophical problem of some difficulty here, which I do not propose to discuss. But somewhere along, all the possible combinations of letters that can occur are what one may call the real names of God. By systematic permutation of letters, we have been trying to list them all. Okay, I see. So you've been starting at A-A-A-A-A-A-A and working up to Z-Z-Z-Z-Z-Z-Z. Well, exactly, although we use a special alphabet of our own. Modifying the electromatic typewriters to deal with this is, of course, trivial. A rather more interesting problem is that of devising suitable circuits to eliminate ridiculous combinations. For example, no letter must occur more than 3 times in succession. 3? I'm surely you mean 2. 3 is correct. I am afraid it would take too long to explain why, even if you understood our language. I'm sure it would, said Wagner hastily. Go on. Luckily, it will be a simple matter to adapt your automatic sequence computer for this work, since once it has been programmed properly, it will permute each letter in turn and print the result. What would have taken us 15,000 years, it will be able to do in 100 days. Dr. Wagner was scarcely conscious of the faint sounds from the Manhattan streets far below. He was in a different world, a world of natural, not man-made mountains. High up in their remote areas, these monks had been patiently at work generation after generation, compiling their lists of meaningless words. Was there any limit to the follies of mankind? Still, he must give no hint of his inner thoughts. The customer was always right. There's no doubt, replied the doctor, that we can modify the Mark V to print lists of this nature. I'm much more worried about the problems of installation and maintenance. You know, going out to Tibet in these days, it's not easy. We can arrange that. The components are small enough to travel by air. That is our one reason why we chose your machine. If you can get them to India, we will provide transport from there. And you want to hire two of our engineers? Yes, for the 3 months that the project should occupy. Well, I have no doubt that personnel can manage that. Dr. Wagner scribbled a note on his desk pad. There are just two other points. Before he could finish the sentence, the Lama had produced a small slip of paper. This is my certified credit balance at the Asiatic Bank. Thank you. It appears to be adequate. The second matter is so trivial that I hesitate to mention it, but it's surprising how often the obvious gets overlooked. What source of electrical energy have you? It's a diesel generator providing 50 kilowatts at 110 volts. It was installed about 5 years ago and is quite reliable. It's made life at the Lamasery much more comfortable, but of course it was really installed to provide power for the motors driving the prayer wheels. Of course, said Dr. Wagner. I should have thought of that. The view from the parapet was vertiginous. But in time, one gets used to anything. After 3 months, George Hanley was not impressed by the 2,000-foot swoop into the abyss or the remote checkerboard of fields in the valley below. He was leaning against the wind-smooth stones and staring morosely at the distant mountains whose names he had never bothered to discover. This, thought George, was the craziest thing that had ever happened to him. Project Shangri-La, some wit back at the labs had christened it. For now, the Mark V had been churning out acres of sheets covered with gibberish. Patiently, inexorably, the computer had been arranging letters in all their possible combinations, exhausting each class before going on to the next. As the sheets had emerged from the electromatic typewriters, the monks had carefully cut them out and pasted them into enormous books. In another week, heaven be praised, they would have finished. Just what obscure calculations had convinced the monks that they needn't bother to go to words of 10, 20, or 100 letters, George didn't know. One of his recurring nightmares was that there would be some change of plan, and that the High Lama, who they'd naturally called Sam Jaffe, even though he didn't look a bit like him, would suddenly announce that the project would be extended to approximately AD 2060. They were quite capable of it. George heard the heavy wooden door slam in the wind as Chuck came out onto the parapet beside him. As usual, Chuck was smoking one of the cigars that made him so popular with the monks who, it seemed, were quite willing to embrace all the minor and most of the major pleasures of life. That was one thing in their favor. They might be crazy, but they weren't blue noses. Those frequent trips they took down to the village, for instance. "Listen, George," said Chuck urgently, "I've learned something that means trouble." "What's wrong? Isn't the machine behaving?" That was the worst contingency George could imagine. It might delay his return, and nothing could be more horrible. The way he felt now, even the sight of a TV commercial would seem like manna from heaven. At least it would be some link with home. No, it's nothing like that, Chuck settled himself on the parapet, which was unusual because normally he was scared of the drop. I just found out what this is all about. "What do you mean? I thought we knew." "Yeah, sure, we know what the monks are trying to do, but we don't know why. It's this crazy thing." "Tell me something new," growled George. "Old Sam, he's just come clean with me. You know the way that he drops in every afternoon to watch the sheets roll out? Well, this time he seemed rather excited, or as near as he's ever going to get to it. When I told him that we were on the last cycle, he asked me in that cute English accent of his if ever I had wondered what they were trying to do, and I said sure, and he told me."
"Yeah, go on, I'll buy it."
"Well, they believe that when they have listed all his names, and they reckon that there are about 9 billion of them, God's purpose will be achieved. The human race will finish what it was created to do, and there won't be any point in carrying on. Indeed, the very idea is something like blasphemy."
"Yeah, so what do they expect us to do, commit suicide?"
No, there's no need for that. When the list is completed, God just steps in and simply winds up things and bingo!"
"Oh, yeah, I get it. When we finish our job, it will be the end of the world." Chuck gave a nervous little laugh.
"Well, that's just what I said to Sam. And you know what happened?
He looked at me in a very queer way, like I'd been stupid in class, and he said, "It's nothing as trivial as that." George thought this over for a moment. "Well, that's what I call taking the wide view," he said presently. "But what do you suppose we should do about it? I mean, I don't see that it makes the slightest bit of difference to us. After all, we already knew that they were crazy." "Yes, but don't you see what will happen? When the list is complete and the last Trump doesn't blow up or whatever it is that they expect, we might get the blame. It's our machine they've been using. I just don't like this situation one tiny bit." "I beg your pardon. We're going to take a brief pause while I deal with a technical issue." Sorry about that. We will now continue with The 9 Billion Names of God by Arthur C. Clarke. "I see," said George slowly. "I mean, you've got a point there, but this sort of thing's happened before, you know. When I was a kid down in Louisiana, we had a crackpot preacher who once said the world was going to end next Sunday. Hundreds of people believed him. They even sold their homes. And yet, when nothing happened, they didn't turn nasty, as you'd expect. They just decided he'd make a mistake in his calculations, and they went right on believing. Some of them, I guess, still do. Well, this isn't Louisiana, in case you haven't noticed. There are only two of us and hundreds of these monks. And I like them, and I'll be sorry for old Sam when his life work backfires on him. But all the same, I wish I was somewhere else." "Well, I've been wishing that for weeks. But there's nothing we can do until the contract is finished and the transport arrives to fly us out." "Well, of course," said Chuck thoughtfully, "we could always try a little bit of sabotage." "Like hell we could. That would make things worse." No, not the way I meant. I mean, look at it like this. The machine is going to finish its run 4 days from now, right? On the present 24-hour-a-day basis. The transport calls in a week. Okay, then all we need to do is find something that needs replacing during one of the overhaul periods, something that will hold up the works for a couple of days. We'll fix it, of course, but not too quickly. If we time matters properly, we can be down at the airfield when the last name pops out of the register. They won't be able to catch us then." "I don't like it," said George. "It'll be the first time I ever walked out on a job. Besides, it would make them suspicious." No, I'm just going to sit tight and take what comes." "I still don't like it," he said 7 days later, as the tough little mountain ponies carried them down the winding road. "And don't you think I'm running away because I'm afraid. I'm just sorry for all those poor guys up there, and I don't want to be around when they find out what suckers they've been. I wonder how Sam's going to take it." "It's funny," said Chuck, "but when I said goodbye, I got the idea he knew that we were walking out on him, and he really didn't care because he knew the machine was running smoothly and the job would soon be finished. After that, well, of course, for him, there just isn't any after that." George turned in his saddle and started up the mountain road. That was the last place from which one could get a clear view of the lamasery. The squat, angular buildings were silhouetted against the afterglow of the sunset. Here and there, lights gleamed like portholes in the side of an ocean liner. Electric lights, of course, sharing the same circuit as the Mark V. How much longer would they share it, wondered George. Would the monks smash up the computer in their rage and disappointment, or would they just sit down quietly and begin their calculations all over again? He knew exactly what was happening up on the mountain this very moment. The High Lama and his assistants would be sitting in their silk robes, inspecting the sheets as the junior monks carried them away from the typewriters and pasted them into the great volumes. No one would be saying anything. The only sound would be the incessant patter, the never-ending rainstorm of keys hitting the paper, for the Mark V itself was utterly silent as it flashed through its thousands of calculations a second. 3 months of this, thought George, was enough to start anyone climbing the wall. "There she is," cried Chuck, pointing down into the valley. "Ain't she beautiful?" She certainly was, thought George. The battered old DC-3 lay at the end of the runway like a tiny silver cross. In 2 hours, she would be bearing them away to freedom and sanity. It was a thought worth savoring, like a fine liqueur. George let it roll around in his mind as the pony trudged patiently down the slope. The swift night of the high Himalayas was now almost upon them. Fortunately, the road was very good, as roads were in that region, and they were both carrying torches. There was not the slightest danger, only a certain discomfort from the bitter cold. The sky overhead was perfectly clear, and ablaze with the familiar, friendly stars. At least there would be no risk, thought George, of the pilot being unable to take off because of weather conditions. That had been his only remaining worry. He began to sing, but gave it up after a while. This vast arena of mountains, gleaming like whitely hooded ghosts on every side, did not encourage such ebullience. Presently, George glanced at his watch. "Ought to be there in an hour," he called back over his shoulder to Chuck. Then he added in an afterthought, "I wonder if the computer has finished its run. It's due just about now." Chuck didn't reply, so George swung around in his saddle. He could just see Chuck's face, a white oval turned toward the sky. "Look," whispered Chuck, and George lifted his eyes to the heaven. "There is always a last time for everything." Overhead, without any fuss, the stars were going out.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds and snakes and airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I am a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world serve its own needs. Dummy serve your own needs. Beat it up. An ox beat grunt. No strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Bite down. High wire and a fire. Representatives have engaged in a government for hire and a combat site. Left to us are coming in a hurry with the furies breathing down your neck. Team my team reporters.
You've been listening to The 9 Billion Names of God by Arthur C. Clarke.
Slice and burn, return, listen to yourself churn. Lock it in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate. Automotive centering, light a candle, light a motor, step down, step down. Watch your heel crush, crush, uh-oh, this means no fear. Cavalier, renegade, steer clear, a tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline. It's the end of the world. Lester Banks, birthday party, cheesecake, jelly bean, boom, symbiotic, patriotic, slam, but neck, right? It's the end of the world as we know it.
Rapid Eye Movement. Well, not really. It's REM. Great song, The End of the World as We Know It. It's not only a wonderful, wonderful collection of science fiction stories, apocalyptic science fiction stories, but there's also a whole lot of fairly good apocalyptic music. Last week, when I was here discussing similar apocalypses, Sydney Smith and R. Paul Martin and Pickles of the North were all here, gathered together. And I went and I asked them, how many apocalypses have there been, given that there's this one and that? And Sydney and R. Paul rightfully pointed out, you can only have the one.
Yeah, there isn't a college of apoculi. I mean, that the apocalypse is it. Although there have been any number of miscalculations and misstatements and so on and so on.
When you're talking about the apocalypse, you're not talking about, you know, this part of the thing or even just Earth or something like that.
You're talking about
in the 9 billion days of God, the universe, the multiverse.
Ends.
That's it. It's, you know, everything goes into the lion's mouth.
The moon turns to blood. The earth gapes and the hounds of hell break forth to lay waste the surface of the earth.
There is one thing that I did consider, by the way, and that's simply the fact that here we are at WBAI this week, and we're not pitching, and that is one of the seven signs.
Absolutely, absolutely. For it is foretold that if an obscure public radio station doth, refrain from refraineth from begging you for alms, then that is truly and surely one of the great signs that the end is indeed upon us. And what is it, tomorrow, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't have to do my laundry then.
That's right. Exactly. Mm. It's so convenient, yeah.
Oh, I don't have to pay rent. This is working out fine.
Yeah,
We have to die. Yeah, okay, that's part of it, but still.
You know, there are people that do that, you know, every time one of these apocalypsi. You see, that was the point as I was at. Oh, I know what it was I asked, not how many there were. Mm. I asked you and R. Paul what the plural.
Apocalypse.
Apocalypse. Yeah. Yes, you know, and apocalypse, apocalypse.
Apocalypse, apocalypse. And the last guy, about a year or two ago, you know.
Harold Camper.
Yeah, you know, he when it didn't quite come off, he was hiding in his bunker.
Yeah.
He didn't want to come out. Sadly, he had a heart attack.
You know, what is the point of hiding?
He was a little embarrassed.
After?
Yeah,
after.
No, I mean, he really thought it was happening.
Well, there are a lot of people that sold their houses, took their kids out of school, moved to mountains. They did the inconstant moon thing, which was almost, as I said earlier, almost the story I was going to read. But we're giving people not a double feature, but a triple feature this morning. We have, we just finished the 9 billion days of God. We are waiting.
9 billion names.
Nine billion names of God.
Yeah.
And we are going to do the star, which if you wanted to hang out for and participate appropriate.
That's too highfalutin for me.
Okay. Yeah.
No, that's too rich for my blood.
Find the bleeping tape.
Yeah. Well, I gave you the tape.
Yeah, so you say, and you may very well have. That was a mistake. I'll find it. Yeah. I'll find it. I looked on the net, and I found a recording, but it wasn't Baird. It was somebody actually imitating
really?
Searles. I mean, you could tell by the gravity of the voice and the way that he read the story, and I listened to it, and I thought, no, I'm not playing that. I'm playing Searles, not a decent imitation of him.
I have somewhere in my...
It's in the archives.
Yeah, the Pacifica archives. I have it on cassette that I, somewhere. And I gave you the reel to reel. We'll do it next year.
We'll do it next year. And I'm just going to contact Brian DeShazer at the Pacifica archives and get it from him.
Do you have? I mean, I remember I gave you long ago the interview I did with Barrett Searles about the science fiction shop.
Yes, that I have somewhere, but I haven't digitized it yet. Right. The amount of stuff that I have in the basement of my house, I have Baird's and Martin Last's collection of tapes. Those are from the 60s, man. I mean, those things need freaking digitizing. I gave Max Schmid one
half hour of me with Ray Bradbury, and it took him approximately 13 to 14 hours to do the recovery job on that.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of the tape, some of them, the oils come out.
Exactly.
You know, and it smears against the heads, and so you have to bake them.
That's what he did.
Yeah.
He baked. I have photographs. I took them with my phone. I have photographs of what the reel of the Bradbury interview looked like. It was just this little mangled, sad
So you feel like, and you got a video of Max shoving a chicken in right next to the tape. So one of these will be ready soon enough, I think.
He gave me the MP3 file, he said, "You want to look at the reel?" I said, "Sure." And I still have that reel because it is a work of modern art, you know, baked Bradbury.
Baked. I poked it. It seemed to be ready. Okay, let's try it.
Baked Bradbury with a touch of Finch.
Yes. Oh, Finch, yes.
Yes, Matthew Finch. It was Matthew Finch, Bradbury, and myself.
There's something I wish I could find of Matthew's. He interviewed the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi here at the station.
Oh, really?
Really, yeah. Unfortunately, you know, like in our troubles.
Well,
around,
he had a lot of
kids,
didn't he?
What, in the year like 2000, 2002, 2003, when we were having this internal nightmare. It was done during that period, and I'm afraid got lost in the chaos of that period. You know,
is it possible Matthew has got?
I would not be surprised if he has the master. You know, because that was a real. I mean, I was here and I was in the other studio, in awe. The man was brilliant. You might want to check if that's on our Pacifica archive or not.
Yeah, I will.
If not, then somebody should get in touch with Matthew Finch, who's out in the station in Arizona, is it?
I think so.
Yeah.
Arizona. We were talking about Arizona earlier. My least favorite state of the union.
There's some place I want to go in Arizona, though. It's the Crater Monument.
Yeah.
The one you saw in Starman, that one. Anyway, of all the places I've wanted to go, besides the old Disneyland, I've always wanted just to be, you know, to be at the bottom of the Crater Monument there.
Yeah.
Just to walk around in there, which I'm told is overrun with scorpions. So maybe that's not a good idea, but still in all.
Yeah. Well, wear boots.
Yeah.
Anyhow, you have a story for us.
A little story. I wrote this 5, 6, 7 years ago, and I read it on my program Saturday morning with the radio on. It's in its new incarnation, but it is like every show has many names and many personalities. Why? I am not only Uncle Sidney, and I am also Uncle Happy, glad as I am to be here. Anyway, this story was dovetails really with the 9 billion names of God, and it's called As a Thief in the Night. If I the first part is in the form of bulletins on the BBC World Service. BBC Bulletin. The sacred cities of Mecca, Jerusalem, Rome, Lhasa, Kyoto, Benares, and Machu Picchu have vanished. There are unreconfirmed reports of other sites sacred to humanity having inexplicably disappeared. Primal forests, jungles, and deserts have taken the place of the disappeared locations. There has been hysteria and violence in the areas surrounding the affected zones. Local police and the military are trying to restore order. In what is presumed to be a related phenomena, both NASA and the European Space Agency have reported that the reflected light of the moon is changing color. It is slowly fading from white to yellow. A government official disclosed that NASA specialists expected the moon to shift to red before the week's end. Neither space agency has observed any solar upheavals that might account for this ongoing event. There are now reports coming in from the night side of the Earth that the stars are beginning to wink out. There has as yet been no confirmation from official sources in the East. However, overseas phone calls, shortwave broadcasts, and internet bloggers are reporting both strange twists of light in the sky and the appearance of winged beings above. Then nothing. Nothing. Static. East 12th Street, Manhattan. I turned the radio off. He was awake again, the man with the terrible wounds. Blinking through red slits, he looked at me. With a tattered rasp, he said, "Agony has become my friend." The man, the angel, coughed molten gold from his ruined lips. "Demons, pain race, did this to me, those wretched children of hell. that rejoice in their dominion over your world. For amusement they plucked out my eyes and gouged off my wings. For spite's sake they infected my soul with doubt, and so severed my umbilical to paradise. After these words, which had the sound of wind through broken glass, the wounded man drifted again into sleep. At midnight there was a distant stumber, a distant thunder. He stirred and awoke. He opened empty sockets, smiled sadly, and said, "Silly rabbit, you have not escaped the fire. You watched your calendars and held your breath for the end, the Mayan end of 2012. Then went back to sleep. But God's time is God's time. She will light her candles and burn her worlds when she pleases." The man angel gently touched my arm and said, "These are the days foretold you. Your tribulation has come." With weary resignation, he said, "Go to the window and look at the sky." I did. I looked. It was gone. There was no sky, no day, no night, no moon, nor stars. Just void. Void. Whispered the angel, "As it was in the beginning, is now, and shall be forevermore." I gazed into heaven's empty chalice. Here at last was an answer to faith, a sign, and most terrible wonder.
Nice. Your usual optimistic.
Only a good Catholic boy could come up with something like this.
Yeah, it's pretty. Yeah, I can see that.
I could see this as my composition in the fifth grade. Sister, I have a story. Oh, that's a very nice little city. Would you like to come to the head of the class and read it? Yes. Ahem.
Well, I wonder how they would have taken the next story. The star is just a lovely brain twister from a man who, well, Clark was an atheist, was he not?
I have to
or
say.
Was he COE?
Oh, a deist. I think a deist.
A deist. Well, that's COE. Yeah. Church of England is.
Well, they wouldn't say that, but I mean, the star is similar.
Episcopalian, COE.
In that at the star has hope in it and an explanation, you know, whereas, you know, my little the jotting, you know, doesn't have hope, but it does have an explanation. It is, you know, my point was she will burn her worlds as she pleases, you know, and even in this story, one of the protagonists, not to give it away, says even now, it's in some place in our universe, some race is being thrown into the fire, you know. And yes.
Yeah. Well, that is. I mean, that's not a spoiler because they tell that pretty much at the beginning. Did you ever see the Twilight Zone?
Yes, I have.
Yeah,
yes,
that
have.
Was pretty well.
That was one of the, you know,
with Fritz Weaver.
You know, that was well done.
Was that George Martin, George R. R. Martin, who wrote that?
I don't know. Yeah. But Fritz Weaver.
He was certainly the story editor at the time, so he certainly had purview over
everything. As a matter of fact, you can see it on YouTube. You can dial up Twilight Zone. The star. And all, you know, it's in three parts. Watch it after the show.
Watch it after you hear the original story.
And see, you know, to this day, it's over 20 years ago. I'm very moved by it, as I am moved by both Baird and Manya.
Baird.
You know, you.
And you've done it well. Didn't you read it?
No, I enjoyed
it. You've only played it.
Yeah, I played it, and on Manya LaBruja, who does Opera Glass, I engineered it, myself and Paul Wunder.
Yeah.
Paul Wunder did the sound effects, and I did the general engineering on that.
Yeah.
And you know it's lost? The Manya reading is lost.
Really?
Yeah. It is lost.
Yeah, I still have her doing Gleepsight by Joanna Russ.
Yeah.
Which I produced. And
I remember that.
And I'm still fairly pleased with that. That's a nice. And there's a whole other concept of literature: the idea of the post-apocalyptic story.
Mm. Oh, I'm a big fan of that.
But again, if we're talking not post-boom.
No, it's...
Or this or that. But if we're using the word in its literal sense, then there is no such thing. Mm. I think there has to be... and our last reading of the New York Review of Science Fiction, by the way, was a collection of stories from an anthology called After. And it was all, well, after. It's science fiction loves Cassandra-like literature. But they also figure, you know, that they have to do the post thing. Whether it's and even the literary thing, like The Road by Cormac McCarthy.
Oh, boy. Holy mackerel. The Road, you know, not what you call your easy reading.
Yeah.
You know, even
nor is it an easy movie.
No, not an easy movie to watch. Actually, the and it's one of the rare cases that the film closely jibes to the book. It is a hair-raising, heartbreaking, grim, realistic look of what is an unclear apocalyptic event. Imagine volcanic eruption out in the Northwest about 30 years ago.
Mount St. Helens.
Right. Imagine a planetary Mount St. Helens.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what the world looked like. Grim. I read it twice. I put the book away. You know, every now and again I look at it on the bookshelf because it was a brilliantly written. And I said, well, I should have another look, you know, this passage or that. And I don't because it is rather like picking up the Bible and just glancing through Revelation. It is not a gleeful trip, okay?
Yeah, Revelation is a bit of a gleeful trip. And
not to me, it ain't.
Well, on Sunday morning at 5 a.m., Cosmic Debris, the original Cosmic Debris, with one Sharon Griffiths.
Sharon.
Sharon did dramatic readings from Revelations with music and stuff in the background, and with music by groups like Squirrel Nut Zippers, you know, you do that stuff right,
yeah.
And it is zonky.
Mm. Actually, that's one thing I want. I don't know if it fits into the apocalyptic vein, but maybe it had to do with an alien invasion short story. And of course, I can't remember the title and I can't remember the author, but you might. It had to do with the alien simply removing one thing from us to bring us down. In this case, cheese.
Sounds awfully British. I don't recall offhand. Sounds like a Terry Pratchett story for that matter.
Who knows? I mean, it's the one thing. They simply removed our ability to make cheese. There is no cheese on Earth. And all the fallout from that, you know.
No Wensley Daily?
No Wensley. Nothing runny either.
Yeah.
Not at all. Any Wensley Dale? No.
Not bad.
Mm-hmm.
Not bad. Well done.
Okay.
Well done. Thank you, Sydney.
Sure, thank you.
And I keep meaning to ask you, have you ever read any, totally away from Apocalypse, any Terry Pratchett?
No. No.
We'll have to fix that.
Not knowingly, Your Honor.
You wouldn't like reading him. He'll make you feel good.
Oh, my heavens. And I thought you were my friend.
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
David Hartwell once said during a panel that I conducted that it is a proven medical fact that reading Terry Pratchett will balance your cholesterol and make your blood pressure go down. And I think he's right.
That will take some doing. Okay, I'll give it a shot.
It's the comfort food of Skiffy. And also there have been a couple of TV productions that aren't bad. Hogfather. That's the one you want to watch for Christmas.
I don't know that one, but I'll look it up.
It's a movie. I'll arrange it for you.
Right.
Okay. Sydney Smith, ladies and gentlemen, Saturday morning, 5 to 6 a.m. Why that's a one-hour slot is beyond me, having inhabited it for, those many years, 5 to 7 a.m. 5 to 7 a.m. is actually a pretty darn good slot. 5 to 6 a.m. is sort of warm-up. This is Hour of the Wolf over listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and over stream.wbai.org. And if we're in the past tense, it is archive
www.wbai.org. But you know what? Just go to wbai.org. We are going to do The Star by Arthur C. Clarke. I need a very brief break, a musical break I will take, just to wet my whistle and all that before we actually get started with the story. So I'm not going to play a long song of any kind. Here is one from 1913, and it is by one Harry Burr, B-U-R-R. Yes, that's really his name. Last night was the end of the world. Henry Burr, sorry. The Star by Arthur C. Clarke. It is 3,000 light years to the Vatican. Once I believed that space could have no power over faith, just as I believed that the heavens declared the glory of God's handiwork. Now I have seen that handiwork, and my faith is sorely troubled. I stare at the crucifix that hangs in the cabin wall above the Mark VI computer, and for the first time in my life, I wonder if it is no more than an empty symbol. I have told no one yet, but the truth cannot be concealed. The data are there for anyone to read, recorded in the countless miles of magnetic tape and the thousands of photographs we are carrying back to Earth. Other scientists can interpret them as easily as I can, more easily in all probability. I am not one who would condone that tampering with the truth, which often gave my order a bad name in the olden days. The crew is already sufficiently depressed. I wonder how they will take this ultimate irony. Few of them have any religious faith, yet they will not relish using this final weapon in their campaign against me, that private, good-natured, but fundamentally serious war which lasted all the way from Earth. It amused them to have a Jesuit as chief astrophysicist. Dr. Chandler, for instance, could never get over it. Well, why are medical men such notorious atheists? Sometimes he would meet me on the observation deck, where the lights are always low so that the stars shine with undiminished glory.
He would come up to me in the gloom and stand staring out in the great oval port while the heavens crawled slowly round us as the ship turned end over end with a residual spin we had never bothered to correct. "Well, Father," he would say at last, "it goes on forever and ever, and perhaps something made it. But how can you believe that something has a special interest in us and our miserable little world? That just beats me." Then the argument would start, while the stars and nebula would swing around us in silent, endless arcs beyond the flawlessly clear plastic of the observation port. It was, I think, the apparent incongruity of my position which, yes, amused the crew. In vain I would point to my three papers in the Astrophysical Journal, my five in the monthly notices of Royal Astronomical Society. I would remind them that our order has long been famous for its scientific works. We may be few now, but ever since the 18th century we have made contributions to astronomy and geophysics out of all proportion to our numbers. Will my report on the Phoenix Nebula end our 1,000 years of history? It will end, I fear, much more than that. I do not know who gave the nebula its name, which seems to me a very bad one. If it contains a prophecy, it is one which cannot be verified for several 1,000,000,000 years. Even the word nebula is misleading. This is a far smaller object than those stupendous clouds of mist, the stuff of unborn stars which are scattered throughout the length of the Milky Way. On the cosmic scale, indeed, the Phoenix Nebula is a tiny thing, a tenuous shell of gas surrounding a single star, or what is left of a star. The Rubens engraving of Loyola seems to mock me as it hangs there above the spectrophenometer tracings. What would you, Father, have made of this knowledge that has come into my keeping, so far from the little world that was all the universe you knew? Would your faith have risen to the challenge as mine had failed to do? You gaze into the distance, Father, but I have traveled a distance beyond any that you could have imagined when you founded our order 1,000 years ago. No other survey ship has been so far from Earth. We are at the very frontiers of the explored universe. We set out to reach the Phoenix Nebula. We succeeded, and we are homeward bound with our burden of knowledge. I wish I could lift that burden from my shoulders, but I call to you in vain across the centuries and the light years that lie between us. On the book you are holding the words that are plain to read, Ad Maiorem Dei Gloriam, the message runs, but it is a message I can no longer believe. Would you still believe it if you could see what we have found? We knew, of course, what the Phoenix Nebula was. Every year in our galaxy alone more than 100 stars explode, blazing for a few hours or days with thousands of times their normal brilliance before they sink back into death and obscurity. Such are the ordinary nova, the commonplace disasters of the universe. I have recorded the spectrograms and light curves of dozens since starting to work at the Lunar Observatory, but 3 or 4 times in every 1,000 years occurs something beside which even a nova pales into total insignificance. When a star becomes a supernova, it may for a little while outshine all the massed suns of the galaxy. The Chinese astronomers watched this happen in A.D. 1054, not knowing what it was they saw. 5 centuries later, in 1572, a supernova blazed in Cassiopeia so brilliantly that it was visible in the daylight sky. There have been 3 more in the 1,000 years that have passed since then. Our mission was to visit the remnants of such a catastrophe, to reconstruct the events that led up to it, and, if possible, to learn its cause. We came slowly in through the concentric shells of gas that had been blasted out 6,000 years before, yet were still expanding still. They were immensely hot, radiating still with a fierce violet light, but far too tenuous to do us any damage. When the star had exploded, its outer layers had been driven upward with such speed that they had escaped completely from its gravitational field. Now they formed a hollow shell large enough to engulf a 5,000 solar systems, and at its center burned the tiny, fantastic object which the star had now become, a white dwarf, smaller than the Earth, yet weighing a million times as much. The glowing gas shells were all around us, banishing the normal night of interstellar space. We were flying into the center of a cosmic bomb that had detonated millennia ago and whose incandescent fragments were still hurtling apart. The immense scale of the explosion and the fact that the debris already covered a volume of space many billions of miles across robbed the scene of any visible movement. It would take decades before the unaided eye could detect any motion in these tortured wisps and eddies of gas. Yet the sense of turbulent expansion was overwhelming. We had checked our primary drive hours before and were drifting slowly towards the fierce little star ahead. Once it had been a sun like our own, but it had squandered in a few hours the energy that should have kept it shining for a million years. Now it was a shrunken miser, hoarding its resources as if trying to make amends for its prodigal youth. No one seriously expected to find planets. If there had been any before the explosion, they would have been boiled into puffs of vapor and their substance lost in the greater wreckage of the star itself. But we made the automatic search, as always, when approaching an unknown sun, and presently we found a single small world circling the star at an immense distance. It must have been the Pluto of this vanished solar system, orbiting on the frontiers of the night. Too far from the central sun ever to have known life, its remoteness had saved it from the fate of all of its lost companions. The passing fires had seared its rocks and burned away the mantle of frozen gas that must have covered it in days before the disaster. We landed, and we found the vault. Its builders had made sure that we should. The monolithic marker that stood above the entrance was now a fused stump, but even the first long-range photographs told us that here was the work of intelligence. A little later, we detected the continent-wide pattern of radioactivity that had been buried in the rock. Even if the pylon above the vault had been destroyed, this would have remained, an immovable and all but eternal beacon calling to the stars. Our ship fell towards this gigantic bullseye like an arrow into its target. The pylon must have been a mile high when it was built, but now it looked like a candle that had melted down into a puddle of wax. It took us a week to drill through the fused rock, since we did not have the proper tools for a task like this. We were astronomers, not archaeologists, but we could improvise. Our original program was forgotten. This lonely monument, reared at such labor at the greatest possible distance from the doomed sun, could have only one meaning. A civilization which knew it was about to die had made its last bid for immortality. It will take us generations to examine all the treasures that were placed in the vault. They had plenty of time to prepare, for their sun must have given its first warnings many years before the final detonation. Everything that they wished to preserve, all the fruits of their genius, they brought us here to the distant world in these days before the end, hoping that some other race would find them and that they would not be utterly forgotten. If only they had a little more time. They could travel freely enough between the planets of their own sun, but they had not yet learned to cross the interstellar gulfs, and the nearest solar system was 100 light-years away. Even if they had not been so disturbingly human as their sculpture shows, we could not have helped admiring them and grieving for their fate. They left thousands of visual records in the machines for projecting them, along with elaborate pictorial instructions from which it will not be difficult to learn their written language. We have examined many of these records and brought to life for the first time in 6,000 years the warmth and beauty of a civilization which in many ways must have been superior to our own. Perhaps they only showed us the best, and one can hardly blame them. But their worlds were very lovely. Their cities were built with a grace that matches anything of ours. We have watched them at work and in play and listened to their musical speech sounding across the centuries. One scene is still before my eyes. A group of children on a beach of strange blue sand, playing in the waves as children play on Earth. And sinking into that sea, still warm and friendly and life-giving, is the sun that will soon turn traitor and obliterate all that innocent happiness. Perhaps if we had not been so far from home and so vulnerable to loneliness, we should not have been so deeply moved. Many of us had seen the ruins of ancient civilizations and other worlds, but they'd never affected us so profoundly. This tragedy was unique. It was one thing for a race to fail and die as natures and cultures have done on Earth, but to be destroyed so completely in the full flower of its achievement, leaving no survivors, how could that be reconciled with the mercy of God? My colleagues have asked me that, and I have given what answers I can. Perhaps you could have done better, Father Loyola, but I have found nothing in the Exertia Spirituala that helps me out here. They were not an evil people. I do not know what gods they worship, if indeed they worshipped any. But I have looked at them across the centuries and have watched while the loveliness they used their last strength to preserve was brought forth into the light of their shrunken sun. I know the answers that my colleagues will give when we get back to Earth. They will say the universe has no purpose and no plan, that since 100 suns explode every year in our galaxy, at this very moment some race is dying in the depths of space. Whether that race has done good or evil during its lifetime will make no difference in the end. There is no divine justice, for there is no God. Yet, of course, what we have seen proves nothing of the sort. Anyone who argues thus is being swayed by emotion, not logic. God has no need to justify his actions to man. He who built the universe can destroy it when he chooses. It is arrogance, it is perilously near blasphemy for us to say what he may or may not do. This I could have accepted, hard though it is to look upon whole worlds and peoples thrown into the furnace, but there comes a point when even the deepest faith must falter, and now, as I look at my calculations, I know I have reached that point at last. We could not tell before we reached the nebula how long ago the explosion took place. Now, from the astronomical evidence and the record in the rocks of that one surviving planet, I have been able to date it exactly. I know in what year the light of this colossal conflagration reached Earth. I know how brilliantly the supernova whose corpse now dwindles behind our speeding ship once shone in terrestrial skies. I know how it must have blazed low in the east before sunrise like a beacon in the oriental dawn. There can be no reasonable doubt. The ancient mystery is solved at last. Yet, oh God, there were so many stars you could have used. What was the need to give these people to the fire that the symbol of their passing might shine above Bethlehem? The Star by Arthur C. Clarke over WBAI, New York.
I played that last week, and I played it this week. And it is a pleasure to play that song. I like that so much. I met Carly Simon. Carly Simon donated a guitar, a Martin Rosewood guitar, to WBAI for an auction. It wasn't for an auction. She just donated it to BAI, and we decided to auction it because, I mean, this was a real deal. This was something major. So this is when we were at the church in Studio C, and I got a friend of mine, a great science fiction writer, although he wasn't one yet, Jack Chalker, came up from Ballmer and was our auctioneer, and we got, $2,300 for it. Then some other WBAI person, who I shall not name, although he has passed on since, stole the guitar and pawned it for like $100, having no idea its value. Sigh. But I got to go. She called up, and I got to go to Carly Simon's apartment in Manhattan and pick up the guitar from her. And, all I could think of were all those wonderful, sexy album covers. And my jaw was just on the floor, I gotta say. I saw James Taylor from a distance as well. It was that period in their history. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. My name is Jim Freund. This is Hour of the Wolf. Not in the Hour of the Wolf, but hey. We have a few minutes if you would like to call and comment on these stories of the apocalypse, or the heat death of the universe, or whatever. Our telephone number here is area code 917-580-6020. Again, it's a very unfamiliar number to us all here. 917-580-6020. We still don't have actual normal phone lines, but our engineers here have worked out a method by which we can take phone calls through our normal system on that phone number. And it's actually rather cool that they can do that. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning, Robert.
I get chills. I don't know how many times I've read The Star and The 9 Billion Names, and I get chills at both endings.
Yeah. And by the way, did anybody notice? I noticed while I was reading them that one of them features the Mark V computer and the other one the Mark VI. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. You mentioned bungled predictions and those that went awry. And two of them that came to mind to me from history. One in 1811, which may have actually altered the course of the War of 1812. I'll explain that to you another time. And, of course, the better one is 1843, which was the basis of Gregory Frost's marvelous novel, Fitcher's Bride.
Yes, absolutely. I cannot read that book. It's too horrific. I mean, it really is gruesome, especially, I mean, especially, I heard him read a portion of it, one of the murders in it, and it's like, I can't sleep now.
Well, he tried to do, James, was he tried to outgrim the Grimm, because he actually based it on Fitcher's Bird.
Yes, I'm aware of that. I have talked to Greg about this at great length. And,
so did I.
Yeah.
Anyway, I wanted to ask you about a short story, and I was thinking about this. This may be in one of those collections, 100 Great Short Fantasies or Science Fiction. I can't remember the author, but I believe the title is Creativity. And it's about a man named William B. Jehovah, who's a solipsist. And for those out there...
The answer to your question is Frederick Brown.
You think it's Frederick Brown? You know the story then.
I more or less remember its existence.
Yeah, well, he's in the hospital. And he believes himself that he's the only reality in an otherwise unreal universe, so he starts to uncreate everything, and by the end of the story, he's floating in the void.
Yeah.
He says, why not start it over again? So he says, let there be light.
Yeah, it's Fred Brown.
That's Fred Brown, yeah. Yeah. And one other thing.
I have 2 minutes. One other thing, but let's make it quick because I want to take other calls.
If you have 2 minutes, you want to take another call, go ahead.
Okay, thanks a lot. Take care. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hi there. Hi, I am not hearing you. I'm hearing something very faint in the background.
Is that me?
Yes, that is you. Now I can hear you.
Hi, darling Jim. How are you?
Okay, how are you doing?
Yeah, I listened last week, but I was in transit coming upstairs now, and I didn't hear what you played of Carly Simon.
Share the End.
Say it again?
Share the End.
Yeah. I just thought, well, I don't have much to say. I'm just so glad you're back on the air, and it was strange hearing myself on Robin's show. That was a repeat before you.
Yes.
I sound so terrible when I'm on the air.
We all do. I cannot. I sound the worst. I cannot listen to me.
No, I love the way you sound.
Well, that's one.
I don't think I sound good. But you always do good work, and I'll let you take another call, because I am so uncomfortable, Robert. Jim. I just want to listen and hear some other callers.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, they've gone away, but I'm pretty much out of time anyway.
Yeah. So you're going to do great stuff. And your music is always out of this world.
Okay. Thanks so
much. Good taste.
Okay. Take care. Nice call. Okay. Let's see. Next week. Yes. Sam Miller and Jen Brissett. Both are doing, as well curators, pardon me, of readings coming up in New York. Jen Brissett has created and hopefully will be the ongoing Kindred reading series. If you know the word kindred, if you know and associate it with science fiction, then you're fully familiar with the works of Octavia Butler. And if you are familiar with the works of Octavia Butler, then this series is for you. If you are not familiar with the works of Octavia Butler, well, then become familiar with them, and then this series will be for you. Basically, it's Skiffy Writers of Color. And I think that's it. Now, Sam Miller is doing a reading event on, I believe it's January 6th. We'll hear more about that when he's here. And that is of gay. He uses the Q word, you know, queer science fiction, LGBT, which to me still sounds like a sandwich, you know. Can I have an LGBT? Hold the mayo, you know. I'm old-fashioned in some ways. I don't like the Q word, for example. I don't, I think, you know, it's, I don't buy this, we're reclaiming the word for ourselves. When I was growing up, it was a curse word. It was a nasty, nasty thing to say, and it was used in nothing but a derogatory fashion. So I don't buy that. But he does, and that's okay. And he's got a reading series, and they will both be there. And maybe I can get Matt Kressel or Ellen Datlow, and then we can have all the New York reading series people together in one place for a talk show fest of readers and writers, because they're also all three of them writers. At any rate, thank you for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and I'll be back next week from 1:30 to 3 a.m. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Collabor with Lister coming your way in just a moment. And instead of our usual outro, something a little more seasonal. Have a good morning. Okay, that is, alas, our internet stream stuttering beyond belief. Let me see if I can do anything here to fix that slightly. Let's give this a whirl. Okay, that's no good. Sorry about this, Lister. It means I'm running over just a tiny bit. It was hardly my intent. But this is what happens when... Okay, let's try it now. Sorry, I just cannot bear to listen to a great Jethro Tull song like that being butchered like that because of technical difficulties. I really, really apologize. But, you know, I was using a cloud service to play some of my musics. And in previous days, it has more or less worked, but not this morning. So we go to our usual outro, and we apologize for all that stuttering and come back. We go out, of course, with Steel I Span and Sails of Silver.
Ropes of fire. Drag it and rip it to-
friends. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the bigs dribble when I burn a cymbal. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fascist and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this shit. These are the places we'll hit.
Number one, Panama. Talking about Peru. Azania. Brixton. Belfast. Can't forget Korea. Beirut. Can't forget Haiti. Iran. Puerto Rico. Colombia. Mexico, talking about uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech and the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
99.5 WBAI. 90.1 on a Sabbath. 99.5 on a Thursday. Burn, baby, burn the show. Yeah. Judge Bork is on that record. I bet you didn't know that, right? Judge Bork. The only record that he's ever been on. The dead judge, Judge Bork, on Burn, Baby, Burn. No wonder they banned that record off black radio in Imperius, America. And then came WBAI that banned the lyrics of that from the radio. I bet you didn't know that. Yeah. Robert Knight on the case right here. 5 o'clock shadow. Don't forget to tune in, you know, your mind. 99 single list alive. This is the flag burning show, y'all. Where we burn the imperialist flag to ashes. 99 single style. Yes, I. Dodoy, dodoy, dodoy.
Bye. you're stealing all the gold. You're rich and drink up with your rich and you reload. You come this home, you must be fight harder than you know. You don't wanna stick your head out the window. It could be cut off from your soul. You're stealing all the gold. Keep running with the money you steal. Don't get caught, you better not slow down. Keep running with the money you steal. So we find it hard to get along. Keep running with the money you steal. Don't get caught, you better not slow down. Keep running with the money you steal. So we find it hard to get along. Oh. La 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 la